Elizabeth Mansfield. Elizabeth is the Director of Personalized Medicine in the Office of In Vitro Diagnostics, Device Evaluation and Safety of FDA.
Thanks, and thanks very much for inviting me. I think we're really going to shift gears quite a bit here to very applied application of a particular kind of IVD testing that's going to relate a little bit more to what Dr. Simon said than to risk, although I agree risk communication is an enormous problem for FDA as well. So I'm going to talk about companion diagnostic tests, and this is a particular type of in vitro diagnostic test that goes together with use of a therapeutic. And we did recently release a draft guidance regarding our policy in terms of these types of tests, in vitro companion diagnostic devices. We had an open comment period for about 90 days, and we're analyzing the comments now in order to finalize this guidance. So what is the guidance about? What it does is define what FDA is going to call a companion diagnostic. A lot of people may include different things in their definition than we do, but we wanted to be quite careful and define exactly what we meant so that people could predict what they had to do. The guidance also describes our policies for how we're going to approve and label these pairs of therapeutics and diagnostics that need to be used together in order to get the safety and effectiveness that we're looking for. It doesn't tell you how to actually do this co-development, how to get to the end with a test and a drug in the same place. It doesn't talk about how to design clinical trials, nothing like that. We do hope to address some of that in some guidances that might see the light of day this year or next year. So, as you're aware from some of the talks I'm sure you've attended today and Dr. Simon's talk, healthcare practitioners are already relying on companion diagnostics and will do so more in the future as we have more come along to help them make really critical treatment decisions. In many cases, the companion diagnostic is going to tell the doctor, should this person get this drug or not? And so these type of tests provide an enormous benefit in optimizing treatment. You can actually give the drug to the person who's most likely to benefit or least likely to have an adverse event. But if the test result isn't right, then you're telling the person the wrong information. You're probably giving them the wrong drug. You may be denying them a drug that would benefit them. You may be giving them a drug that might harm them. So our regulatory concept is that not only the drug, but the diagnostic needs a pre-market review, and we really want to look at them together. How do they interact? And what our goal is to be able to approve the drug and the diagnostic at the same time so that they sort of fit together. And we've achieved that twice this year with Zalcori and I forget what the trade name of Venurafimib is, Zelbraf, and their respective tests. And Dr. Woodcock said the other day, you know, she doesn't really know if this is the beginning of the tidal wave of wonderful new combinations that are coming along or if this is a fluke. But certainly we see a lot of interest in this type of development. So we've tried to get out in front a little bit and try to assure that the diagnostic, the test that's used to actually tell the physician, okay, how do I use this drug, has actually been validated very carefully for the way that it's supposed to be used and that we apply risk-based regulation. And we think, in fact, most of these tests, in our minds, are high risk because if you make a mistake, you're really exposing a patient in a way that you shouldn't be. And some people have said, well, you know, what's the option? You would just give it to everyone. So, but realistically, when you can make a decision, we want you to make the right decision. So I mentioned already that we want to see co-approval because these two things depend on each other, and in fact, we're going to require it in most cases. And this is a big business model shift for many of the companies that have been working both in the therapeutic and the diagnostic space. There are some exceptions that will exist, you know, for life-saving drugs and if there's not a test ready and all of that. But in general, our perspective is that if there's no test available to be approved when this drug that requires it is ready to go, then the drug's not going to be approved. So it's pretty important, and this message was very important to actually get out in the form of guidance so that people really understood you know, what they were going to be aiming for. And certainly the post-market issues we have. Once you approve a drug or a diagnostic test, over time you want that thing to continue to perform in the same manner that it did when it was studied. So we have what we call post-market systems and quality system controls that are supposed to assure that 5 years from now you're getting the same drug and you're getting the same test and that the interaction is the same. So that's another aspect of regulation. So as I mentioned, we wanted to define exactly what we thought a companion diagnostic was so that there wouldn't be any doubt for people coming in the regulatory door. So we defined it as a medical device that identifies or determines a condition of use for a therapeutic product and is important to ensure the safe and effective use of the product. It's a, perhaps boil it down a little bit. If you need the test in order to make the drug safe and effective, then that test is a companion diagnostic. And I'll mention here some various scenarios in which we envision tests being companion diagnostics, and that would be to select likely responders or people likely to suffer severe adverse events in a predictive manner. And the trial would be marker positive and negative in many cases. Certainly, we've seen a lot of cases where the test is actually used for population selection. The trial is only in marker positive patients. We don't know what the predictive value is. We only know who was studied. So we are willing to approve those tests, but the intended use of the test is to actually match the clinical trial population. It's not to predict anything about whether the drug will work in a particular person or not. In the prognostic area, certainly we would expect that there would be certain cases where if a person's prognosis were quite poor, you might want to treat them with a particular drug, whereas if they had a good prognosis, you wouldn't want to. I think tamoxifen was mentioned as something maybe you wouldn't want to get if you didn't really want to need it because it raises your risk for other things that aren't so great. Certainly, there are areas, especially in immune modulation, where we want to look at where there's very narrow therapeutic windows, where monitoring the therapy to make sure the person is actually where they're not going to be harmed and stand to get the most benefit is important. And in some cases, individualizing the therapeutic dose, where you really need to get on the right dose right away. And in one example that's actually not really a companion diagnostic, but would fit this, is like warfarin, is a drug that has a fairly narrow therapeutic window, but it's a little bit different in everyone, and you want to get the person on the right dose right away. So these are the kind of scenarios of things that we think might be companion diagnostics. And the way that we would communicate this to the public and to physicians who would use this is through not only through the therapeutic product labeling, where the indications and usage section might say, we really need to do this test in order to decide whether you want to use this drug. Or in the warnings and precautions section of the label, I don't know how many of you have ever read a drug label, but if you can even find these, let me know, where it says, be really careful in this population, use this test because you might not want to use this drug in certain people. So, and we proposed, just as a little regulatory aside, that we wouldn't actually name the particular test, that we'd just say use an FDA-approved test so that we could kind of allow things to evolve over time and not have to do drug label changes and so on, unless the drug really depended on some test that was really peculiar and couldn't be replicated in any other way, then we might name it. So, so how would we label the diagnostic part? We go to intended use, which is really, really specific and talks about the therapeutic product and the exact population that you're talking about. Are you talking about, you know, stage 3, you know, node negative, whatever? The companion diagnostic is going to match what's in the therapeutic label in many cases and talk about the specific therapeutic. And it will also talk about whether the test is applicable to more than one therapeutic product. For example, we consider there might be class effects that could be tested for in a class of drugs where you would expect the same sort of selection for response or against adverse events. Maybe there's not a class effect, in which case you would say this doesn't apply to every drug in the class, it only applies to this one. But at any rate, as these come along, as new indications would come along and be added to a companion diagnostic label, and one example is the test for HER2, we've just added recently the indication for gastric cancer. HER2 is now acceptable for use in gastric cancer. As we go through a whole new regulatory process and we add something to the label, and it actually turns out to be fairly easy because we accept data from clinical trials of the drug rather than requiring people to go out and do separate trials to show the diagnostic performance. So our enforcement expectation is everybody's got to comply. If the companion diagnostic, if the drug comes forward with a companion diagnostic, then we want to see the companion diagnostic. We want to evaluate it, and we want to prove it, because we think the performance is really a critical issue here. And we don't really care who the manufacturer is, if it's a giant company that pumps out 10,000 kits a day, or if it's a little lab that's, you know, pipetting away according to their little homebrew recipe. And we really think appropriate labeling is needed, because that's going to give the guidance. How do I use these two things together, and how do I make decisions? So there's a lot of information that's not in the guidance, as I mentioned earlier, investigational use. A lot of people aren't aware that if you actually use a test that you don't know how it performs in that particular situation, that's an investigation. So the tests that are used in these clinical drug trials to make critical decisions, which arm are you going to go into, which therapy are you going to get, and so on, those are investigational tests. We require investigational approval. This can be through various mechanisms. It can come through the device side. It can come through the therapeutic side. But what we're trying to do is mitigate the possibility of serious risk to the patient within the trial. We have a lot of issues that we've seen in co-development, many of them related to misunderstandings about how well a test should be known to work, and some statistical issues that are actually quite simple but confuse people a lot. The test analytical performance, as Dr. Simon mentioned, needs to be really nailed down. You need to know how that thing measures, and you need to know that the measurement is constant over time and over location and so on, so that you're always getting the same result no matter where you are or when you are. We see problems that people actually haven't done the analytical performance, so they can't tell us how well it works, which is a big deal, because then we don't know who they've selected. We see cases in which multiple tests, which we assume have different performance, are used to enroll subjects in a clinical trial. Well, all the tests perform differently. They're all going to select different people. So who's your population? You're not sure. And when who you're treating is actually based on who you've tested and who was positive, this is a great big deal, and has turned into a giant problem for certain therapies. We see a lot of attempts to use a clinical trial assay, and that's an assay that's really not for marketing. It's some kind of, maybe prototype assay or something that's a little more complex than what would want to be marketed, where people want to bridge from this clinical trial assay to some kind of companion diagnostic that they would market, but they haven't got the samples from the trial to do that. And KRAS and cetuximab was a big problem here. You get this huge issue of bias. When you don't have all the samples, who's missing? Why are they missing? Who's there? Why are they there? So you're not really sure if that's a representative population or if that's a completely non-representative population. So we're recommending that sponsors actually get those samples and keep them in case something like this comes up. That turns out to have a lot of issues. There's informed consent. There's actually being able to obtain those samples if you aren't the person who collected them. There's just all kinds of problems there, but they've got to be worked out in order for this pathway to be successful in any way. And certainly, we, in the beginning of this whole enterprise, were quite worried about these marker-positive-only trials. That we got no predictive information out of them, because you're only testing one stratum, only the marker-positive, so there's no way to predict. And so we were holding our heads and wondering, how are we going to manage this? And we finally decided, well, that's just who's in the trial, so we'll just describe who's in the trial. You get a selection claim. You don't get a predictive claim. And I think everybody's been pretty comfortable with that. Certainly, in the enrollment issues, I did mention using different tests was a big problem for us. We really like people to either use one site to do all the testing so that you get a uniformity of testing, or figure out how to do the same tests at all sites. Use the same protocol, the same ingredients, the same, everything, so that you're enrolling comparable people at every different site. And, of course, we want to know that any test has been adequately analytically validated. So what is analytical validation? Well, that's a measure of test performance in its measurement properties, whatever they may be, whether it's a qualitative test, whether it's a quantitative test, or any other kind of test. But we want as complete an analytical validation as possible so that there isn't any doubt. Is this test really linear across the entire range that I'm using it for? Does it really measure all the mutations that are relevant and so on? We really want to know that up front. For for tests that detect multiple possible genetic changes. This is becoming a big deal now. The BRAF story is actually a good example of this. There are actually multiple different changes you can get at V600. The trial for crizotinib primarily looked at people who had the E, V to E change, but there are others. There's V to K, and there's a couple others. So what we want to know is that the test that you're using actually can measure everything that you're looking at, and that was an issue in the trial, is was the test actually only measuring E, or was it measuring K, or was it measuring P, and what was really in there? So we had to sift through that and pick out only the E's, because that was the original claim. And certainly we have a lot of issues with the specimens that are tested, and if you've ever hung around Carolyn Compton from NCI or anybody like that, your hair would be as white as hers, because it's such a problematic issue. And what we're seeing in trials often is that it's quite convenient often to test the surgical tissue in cancer and so on. So you've got an FFPE block or something, but ultimately you want a blood test. We don't know how to compare these unless you collected paired samples so that you have a blood that came from the same person at approximately the same time as the tissue came from it, so we can compare and say yeah, the blood works comparably, or it has a little bias up or down or whatever. So this is something that we're a little worried about. I think most people have the message now that they need to start with the sample that ultimately is tested. Again, back to the marker-positive only trials. This is where you're choosing only one stratum. It's usually based on biology because you have a targeted drug. In cancer, this has become rather large. It may get outside of cancer, but I don't think biomarker activity is quite as common there. So the benefits of this are, as has already been described, is it can be significantly more efficient if you can justify the biological rationale for doing marker positive only. And certainly when safety is an issue, you do avoid exposing people who might actually be harmed by the drug, and you don't want to do that if you know ahead of time, or actually exposing people who have no chance of benefiting. Of course, the problems with that is you don't get any marker by treatment information. As I mentioned, we've kind of learned to live with that. We can't assess the predictive value of the test. Seems to be okay. And I think the biggest thing is, without good mechanistic biological data, you can really mislead yourself. The cetuximab and panitumumab cases were really really a case where we thought the target was the EGFR receptor. And so if you overexpress the EGFR receptor, then you'd be the one likely to benefit from that drug. Well, it turns out that wasn't true. It seems that people who don't apparently overexpress the EGFR receptor also benefit, and it's KRAS and the actual signaling pathway that drives the response, and not the amount of receptor on the surface of the cell. Although there may be some dose effect there, we don't know. So the mechanistic data there led us to believe that it should be the EGFR receptor. Turns out that wasn't right. So in some cases, you can end up with a trial that might be a mess. Again, the testing protocol has to be pre-specified, can't be altered once the trial's begun, so you know who's in the trial. Again, we want sponsors to save samples from all the patients enrolled in the trial if possible. For those people that are doing test positive only patients, we're having another huge issue now, and it's partly related to next generation sequencing, if you guys are familiar with that, is it's so easy to pre-screen people for eligibility now with a different test than will be used. And then you get the problem that never occurs in real life of people having two tests, which is problematic in that they can disagree. So which one is right? You get this discordance. You get the statistical issue of resolving the discordance. And it creates a big problem for us. So we really don't like it when people pre-screen, although in real life it seems like that's what people want to do. They want to be able to send their patients to a trial where they're most likely to be enrolled and have some benefit. And we also like to see when patient samples are sent forward for testing to see if they can be enrolled in the trial, that the lab actually saves some from people who are test negative, even though they may never be treated, because this gives us something to go on analytically, that we can actually see how a test-negative specimen performs. I already talked about the paired samples, and of course storage of samples prior to testing is a big problem, because analytes degrade and change and do all kinds of funny things over time that can really fool you. So we like people to look very carefully at that. So our policy and guidance, I'm not sure this audience is all that interested, but we do have sort of protocol meetings in the Center for Devices where we try to work out issues before the trial begins. We like to have the diagnostic and the pharmaceutical people in the same room because, believe it or not, they don't understand what each other are saying. And so if you rely on one to tell the other, that the story gets completely garbled. I think I've talked about everything else except for the fact that a lot of people have been very wary of this whole model that somehow we would require a separate clinical trial for the diagnostic device in addition to the clinical trial for the therapeutic. In fact, we don't. We take all the diagnostic information out of the therapeutic trial and analyze it and put that into the label. So I think it's important to know that when a companion diagnostic is intended to be used, there's no real difference whether you're going for accelerated approval or normal approval. You got to plan ahead. If you're actually going to get approval on a phase 2 trial, you better have done the companion diagnostic early. And as I just mentioned, the analysis of the diagnostic device performance is actually going to come out of the therapeutic trial. So if the trial fails, the diagnostic fails. If the trial wins, the diagnostic is generally considered informative and will reflect use in the pivotal trial, and we don't actually look for any additional clinical validation of the diagnostic. And the relabeling really is I'm going to skip over that. So the guidance is really that we need people to talk to us and tell us what they're doing, that we have multiple centers to coordinate, and it's good for them to know. With like a big red flag on the submission, hey, guess what, call the other center quickly, get yourselves together and give us good advice. Really, a lot of this is common sense. Think about it a little bit. Plan ahead a lot. Don't rely on shortcuts, post hoc fixes. Get to know the other half of whoever you are, if you're pharma, be friends with your diagnostic partner or the other way around. And certainly, you can always ask us if we're confused. We have a pretty good stable of people who understand what's going on and can give you good advice. So I'll stop there, and if there are any questions.
Questions? Yes. Gave me, tested my brain, hooked me up. They gave me something, I don't remember the exact drug. I went home to take it, some big pills, and I did read the stuff, a lot of information.
Yeah.
It said this can cause death, it can cause heart failure, it can cause kidney failure. And after I done, I said, do I want, what's my probability? And I never took it, I threw it down the drain.
Yeah.
I would have preferred if it said to me, a black guy over 40, over whatever age, so the probability that of failure is 10%. And then I would have been able to make, but after I could die, I had failure, all these different things.
Right.
Not this, but
right.
A lot of information, but not this one.
Right. So that reflects generally the size of clinical trials, that you don't pick up the rare adverse events in a way that you can actually quantify what your risk is for developing them. If you have a trial of 500 people and one person has liver failure, you can't say that every one in every 500 people is going to have liver failure on this drug. The trial's just not big enough to show you that. Certainly every drug that I know of has risks. And if FDA has evaluated it, then it's determined that the benefits in the population outweigh the risk in the population. And as people have mentioned before, that's very different than your individual benefit-risk calculation, which cannot be performed by FDA. It's simply on you to decide whether you're willing to risk death, liver injury, and so on, in order to have your head feel better. That's just a fact of risk-benefit calculation. You simply can't do it on individuals without a tremendously greater amount of information than we have available now for biology. So I would say the answer to your question is donate heavily to the government so that the biology can be generated and we can predict these things with more certainty.
I think very shortly at major cancer centers, all patients will have their tumors sequenced completely in CLIA certified laboratories. How will that interact?
Yeah, we're a little worried about that in terms of having, you know, multiple tests performed on patients prior to enrollment in the trial. On the other hand, it's also possible that in clinical laboratory medicine that people will have an exome sequence of their tumor so that the test that's done pre-screening is actually the same test that will be used in the lab. So, you know, because these one-off tests that, you know, you have to measure this molecule on this platform with this test and this molecule on this platform really drive people crazy. What they'd really like to do is have one platform and be able to do all the testing. And sequencing has some attributes of that, although some things are not sequence-based at this time. For example, protein overexpression, you can't measure by sequencing. You can only look at mutations in DNA changes and RNA changes. So, short answer, I don't know.
Cancer, I think that's where it's all going.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think so, but I'm not sure so. We still see a lot of sort of semi-quantitative IHC kind of stuff, 1 plus, 2 plus, 3 plus, where nobody really understands the genetic basis of why you have this variation. So, yeah, we're not positive.
You're saying that you would require an FDA-approved test as a companion diagnostic. Mm-hmm. How would that relate to a patient who got on the trial based on a mutation detected when they had their exome sequence at a CLIA-certified lab?
Right. I'm not sure. We're still working through that. There's a lot of big issues like that that have popped up out of nowhere. I mean, next-gen sequencing basically came on the clinical scene in about a year. That's a lot faster than we've seen technology run in the past, and so we're running after it, trying to answer questions like that.
Any other questions for either Liz or anybody else in the session?
Okay, thanks.
Let's begin.